All right, you guys ready?
All ready.
All right, guys. Well, welcome to this week's edition of The Sword and Staff. I'm one of your hosts, Josh Robinson, and joining me today, as always, is my co-host,
Richie Brock.
And on today's episode, we are once again joined by our good friend, Ward Heine. And today, we are going to talk about our trip to Point Pleasant and what it was like being on the trail of the Mothman. And so, should be an interesting episode. Hope you guys are excited about it. We had a good time in Point Pleasant. Did you guys? At least I had a good time. Did you guys have a good time whenever we went?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I thought that it was really interesting. I thought that we checked out some interesting things, and which I'm sure that we'll talk about and hear about in this episode. But yeah, so Ward, thanks for joining us once again. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day and out of your busy schedule to do that. And so it's always a pleasure having you on with us. And we're glad that you got to go on the trip with us. A lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a ton of fun. I'm excited to be here. I think the last time I had been in Point Pleasant and out at TNT was like 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was just, I didn't have any kind of, you know, at the time, the closest thing to a conception of what Mothman might be that I had was like, you know, flesh and blood. Oh, I guess there might have been a thing,
right?
And so it's interesting to go back now with the added context of you know, spiritual beings and elemental spirits and possibly all kinds of other craziness on that side of it.
Yeah, that's pretty much my experience too. Richie is the resident weirdo here. So
weirdo.
Richie has been to Point Pleasant like every year of his life. That's where he like celebrates his birthday at.
For the past at least 7 years.
Yeah. So, but for me, I hadn't been there since, so it had been about a decade for me. Whenever my little brother was a senior in high school, we went there because his football team played Point Pleasant. And I had been there like a year or two prior to that, and my cousin and I had checked out the Mothman statue because we had never been to Point Pleasant. And at the time, I had just gotten a new car and we just wanted to go out and drive, you know, that kind of thing. So it had been, you know, about that long for me too. And whenever I was there, like first time I was there, I wasn't even a Christian. And then the second time I was there, I was. And I definitely did not have the categories that I have today going in this, you know, those times. So it was definitely interesting. So I'll kind of get us started with our conversation and just kind of state up front what our goal was. So we've talked about Dark Holler and, you know, all of those things, right? We did an episode together. And so we're kind of looking at the phenomena kind of beyond this particular case, right? Kind of taking a step back and looking at it and seeing it in other places. And for me personally, and maybe you guys can speak to this too, because maybe you guys had particular things you wanted to accomplish in this trip as well. But for me personally, one of the things that I really wanted to try to dig into with this trip is what makes a window area, right? And so some of our listeners may not be familiar with that language, right? Like what a window area is. And basically, to kind of get you guys up to speed and to give you a definition, a window area in the world of the paranormal is basically a term, if I'm not mistaken, that John Keel kind of came up with. And basically what it is you can think of it this way. A window opens and it closes and it lets things in, right? So Keel kind of theorized that there were places geographically that were window areas. And basically right. What happens is the window opens at times and it allows for paranormal phenomena to happen, a lot of it. And that, so in the 60s, that's what you saw in Point Pleasant, right? You had the Mothman phenomena, and then you had things like cattle mutilations going on. You had crazy, crazy reports of UFOs. You had reports of the Men in Black. You had reports of a alien-like being called Indrid Cold, who was visiting people and talking with people. And so you just had this just various types of phenomena happening in this area. And that's what we call high strangeness, right? Is whenever it's not just, you know, one weird thing going on in a place, but various amounts of high, weird stuff. That's what constitutes high strangeness. And so for me, reading people like John Keel, and for me, I have always been curious, like, what makes a window area a window area? Like, is there criteria that makes a window area a window area? And if there is, what is that criteria? And what can open a window area? What can close a window area? Those are the I'm kind of interested in those nuts and bolts types of questions. And I really become interested in it. I'd listen to an interview talking about John Keel and some of his methodology. And the guy basically said that, you know, people like him and Jacques Vallée, who we've talked about in our UFO episode that we did. So you need to go back and listen to that if those names sound unfamiliar to you. They talk about that, you know, Keel basically talked about the window area stuff. He talked about, you know, unified theory and the ultra terrestrials and that type of stuff, but he didn't necessarily dive into the nuts and bolts of it. So somebody was like, this guy that I was listening to was basically saying that there is a need for somebody to dive into that side of this thing. And for me, that's like, that's the realm I live in. Like, I have to know how things work. So yeah. For me, like, I was just genuinely interested in that. And so I've got some theories about what maybe makes that. I have a hypothesis that I'm testing, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But I have a hypothesis as one of the things that could make that place a window area that I'm testing. And so, but for me, that's kind of what I came into this with, that. And I wanted to see the phenomenon just kind of at a larger level. So I don't know if you guys had personal things you wanted to look into while you're there, but if so, I'll give you guys the floor.
I mean, for me, it was sort of looking back and honoring what the form the phenomenon has taken in the past. Like looking at the mask, the Mothman, even Flatwoods Monster, things like that. And by looking at that, identifying patterns of how it might be manifesting now in the present. And like, where do we go with this next? Where do we go with this now?
Yeah, that's good. Ward, I don't know if you had anything.
Yeah, for me, I think one of the really interesting things that I came to discover, or at least maybe suspect, is a more circumspect way of saying it. But during the shooting of Dark Holler, and following that story with you guys over the past like year, I found it really interesting the like real world relationship between symbols and these phenomena that people are talking about experiencing. And whether those are, you know, numbers, which are symbols, or actual, what, you know, referred to as synchronicity, or we came to start referring to them as providences, because it seemed like they were sort of leading the way down a path. And so I kind of wanted to see, you know, my hypothesis that I had come to suspect over this past year is that there's some sort of, whether it's an entity, there's some sort of connection between much of the weird and the strange, specifically in Appalachia, and, you know, the connections between Logan and Point Pleasant in history with Cornstalk and Aracoma.
Yeah,
was sort of the first link in that chain. And then the more just synchronicity type stuff that we ran into, it seemed like, you know, it was the place to go.
Yeah. Yeah, that seemed to be like, what better place could we go than this? This is the epicenter of this type of phenomenon weirdness in West Virginia, and, you know, maybe on this side of the East Coast. I don't know. I mean, it's whenever the phenomenon was big in Point Pleasant, it was big. I mean, it was nationwide. Like, people, right. This stuff was huge. So
yeah. And the UFO activity, like, people hear that, oh, there were UFO sightings, but if you haven't read Mothman Prophecies, it was like nightly predictable going up to the same place to watch UFOs. Like, it was a pastime in the town.
Yeah. It was, I mean, shoot, even some of the guys that we talked to was talking about going and watching.
Yeah, they can remember that in real time.
Yeah, so we can talk about that a little bit more. But yeah, I thought that it would be interesting right off the bat to just kind of talk about like what it was that each of us was wanting to accomplish with this trip. And I think that we're all pretty much on the same page. Like, we're all kind of have our own unique things that we're trying to figure out and to see how it all fits in together. So all right. So to kind of get us started though, we'll just kind of just tell the story of our trip and what we experienced, and we can dive into particular parts of it as we go along. But so at about 9:45 a.m., Richie and I arrived in Point Pleasant. Ward, you beat us there. I don't know how long you were there prior to us getting there.
Yeah, like half an hour just shooting B-roll.
Yeah, okay. So we got there at about 9:45 in the downtown area. The Mothman Museum wasn't open yet. We had about 15 minutes until it opened. And so we figured that we would just start our trip off by going down to the 2 Indy Way State Park, which is just down the flood wall from the downtown area. It's kind of like on the peak of Point Pleasant, out in where the Ohio River and the Kanawha River converge. But it's a state park, and that's where Chief Cornstalk is buried. It's also where the Water Panther Stone is at too. So we figured like, hey, right, you know, we've got a little bit of time to kill. It's just down the flood wall here. So we'll go down and check this out. We'll start here. And so right off the bat, we're greeted with providences or synchronicities, right? We're walking down by the Ohio River, and the first thing that we come to is like this shelter that I guess the city has built, and on both sides of it there are owls. Yeah. Which, if anybody's listened to, you know, the stuff that we've talked about with Dark Holler, and you know that owls is a huge synchronicity in that story. Right. So,
yeah. And these two in the shelter, I feel like it always starts like this. These two were like serving the ostensible purpose that an owl statue serves. Like, they're up there to keep birds from landing on the shelter and pooping. So these two like made sense that they were there, and absent any of the context of any, you know, the previous experiences, it would just be, okay, that's two owl statues. That's perfectly normal. It wasn't until later. So,
yeah, so that's why I wanted to preface it that way. Just like, hey, you know it made sense that they were there. They're there to scare out, you know, birds off and other, you know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, right off the bat, you're like, huh, yeah, there's the owls. You laugh and you kind of go on about your business. And so we go on, so we get down to the state park, and that's where we did our first live stream. And so that's on our Instagram. But there we were checking out the Cornstalk grave. And so for those of you guys who don't know, Chief Cornstalk, he was murdered in Point Pleasant in 1777, murdered at Fort Randolph. And whenever he died, he infamously pronounced a curse on Point Pleasant whenever he was dying. And it was said to be a 200-year curse. And so it's interesting. To me, it's interesting because this tribe who was in Point Pleasant and who was led by Chief Cornstalk, they were also in kind of my hometown, just down the road here in Logan, West Virginia. So the daughter of Chief Cornstalk, her name is Princess Aracoma. She died in Logan, West Virginia, and is buried downtown at the courthouse. So she has a monument down there. And interestingly enough, they worship the same deities, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I don't know, we've talked about that a little bit already, so I won't rehash all of that. But but anyway, you know, some of the interesting things there though was that the Cornstalk monument, which is an obelisk and there are a ton of obelisks in Point Pleasant.
There really is.
Yeah. A ton of obelisks. And I actually did a little bit of research into obelisks since we've been back. And this comes from James Jordan's Through New Eyes. And Richie and I were talking about it a little bit prior to the first episode that we recorded this morning. I got to find it because I lost my place. Richie, I don't know if you want to hold that up to the camera because I think we're actually going to release the video today. So that's from James Jordan's Through New Eyes. And there in it, there are multiple different types of markers that denote holy grounds. You can paint it back to me. Everybody, so these are what he calls them are ladders to heaven. And the obelisk is one of them, but you've got the holy mountain there. You've got the ziggurat, the pyramid, stones, pillars, but then you've got altars too, which are ladders to heaven. And so there's one here called Ezekiel's altar, which so interestingly is shaped exactly like the water panther
stone.
It's shaped exactly like the water panther stone. You can put that back up there to the camera. But it's basically like a miniature ziggurat. It's right there. And the interesting thing is that at Cornstalk's grave, there's an obelisk there. He's buried at an obelisk. And then that's not to mention the ginormous obelisk that is in the middle of the Tuendi Way State Park, which is, I think, dedicated to, Lord something. I can't remember his name in the Virginia Army. But yeah, so that was really interesting. And like the symbolism of that park. To me, I was like, "This they're saying this is holy ground."
Dude, and even the two old cemeteries, the historic cemeteries out there in town.
Yeah.
All the Mason graves, Masonic graves, were obelisks.
Yeah, which, I found out that that's major Masonic symbolism too, the obelisk. Right. And so the thought behind it is that whenever you put these little tiny obelisks in places, they're said, not only are they connecting heaven and earth, kind of like a pyramid or a ziggurat would, which is what the altar is doing there. So we'll touch back on that here in a minute. But that's what they're doing. They're connecting heaven and earth, but they're said to be kind of like needles that channel energy. And what,
like a spiritual antenna.
Yeah, it's kind of like an antenna in some ways. But from what I understand is that they would put little obelisks in areas and that would connect them energetically to places where larger obelisks were at, from what I understand, which is a fascinating proposition. If you think about it, because there's a gigantic obelisk there.
Right.
And then there's a bunch of little tiny ones all over the place. So it's kind of like connecting those areas together.
Yeah, occultists with their like ET phone home kind of antennas out there.
Yeah.
Did you, I don't know if you guys recognize this, and it just now occurred to me as you're talking about the ladder to heaven concept, but one of the, and we'll get to this later, but one of the paintings in that room,
it's a tree,
depicted someone ascending a ladder to heaven.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I just saw the picture of the tree on there and it just clicked for that too.
Yeah, the tree is the same thing. It's the ladder to heaven too. There's a lot of interesting parts with this already.
Realizations in real time.
Yeah, realizations in real time. So anyway, so while we were there, we checked out the grave of Chief Cornstalk. And we had some EMF meters with us, and there was another meter. That's your world. What was the other meter that we had?
We had a MEL meter, MEL 8704 meter, and a K2 meter.
Yeah, K2 meter. What's the K2 meter? It doesn't do the exact same thing, right?
It reads sort of the same scale, but in a more grouped and broader sense. Okay. It's mainly used for communication, the way it's designed.
Okay, gotcha. So we were running EMFs while we were in the park, and then we come across what's called the Water Panther Stone. And basically the Water Panther Stone was an altar that they found in a place called Leon, which is just down the road from Point Pleasant. But basically the way that it was shaped, Richie, you can show this. I drew it.
Josh taking Indiana Jones
field notes
over here.
Yeah. So
sketched out the Water Panther Stone.
Those are my field notes. That's the Water Panther Stone. But as you can see, it's shaped very much like the altar in James Jordan's depictions. And that's very intentional. The reason why it's shaped that way is because that's what it was. It was an altar. And there's actually a sign put there by the state that says this was an altar that was offered, where offerings were left to the deities of the Native Americans here. And Cornstalk's tribe, they made offerings on this. Now, the interesting thing is on it, there is a petroglyph of what's called the Water Panther. And basically, the Water Panther is the deity.
Yeah, I was going to say, dig into the symbolism there.
Yeah, well, basically, the Water Panther is the deity that lives beneath the waters of the earth. Like, he is like the keeper of the realm of the dead.
That's just not exclusive to here, Appalachia.
Right. Yeah, no, yeah, that goes even beyond Appalachia. But he's kind of this deity of chaos, the waters of the earth, the dead, right? That kind of stuff. Very similar to the biblical symbolism of Hades that we've talked about, right? So anyway, so they were offering sacrifices to, like, the Lord of the Dead, you know, that kind of thing. And anyway, so it was interesting because we were running EMS and we didn't get anything in the park except the Water Panther Stone. And there were, like, little tiny, like, trinkets and sacrifice, you know, offerings that people had offered left on it while we were there. And it was so funny, like, just pulled out. I was using one on my phone that was measuring in micro Teslas. But yeah, like, there was just a significant spike there at that, and couldn't figure out why. Like, there was no electricity running around it. We checked it out. So there was nothing there, you know, man-made that would have spiked it. So we didn't dig back into it. That's something we'll have to revisit whenever we're there another time. But yeah, I don't know if you guys want to speak to any more of that, but.
Well, one of the offerings was a bundle of sage atop the Water Panther Stone, which we then found a second matching bundle of sage left on the obelisk that I think was Cornstalk's grave.
Yeah.
Or marker, memorial anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and it looked as if someone had left them both.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. They were definitely wrapped in the same way. Like, whoever did one did the other, I would bet. So it's interesting that people were still yet, like, leaving offerings there on this stuff. And so,
I mean, Cornstalk's descendants are, there's still a few in the area that live in the area. So that really cling to the native culture. So, I mean, sage in the native culture is a symbol of purification, peace. So to link the Water Panther Stone and Cornstalk's grave, I can see if it could have been somebody associated with him.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it could just be a cultist or whoever.
Yeah. So another interesting thing too here, to just kind of touch on Cornstalk stuff and the hypothesis that I have on some of this stuff. One of the hypotheses that I have. So the Water Panther is one spiritual being that they're worshiping. The other is the Thunderbird, which is kind of like the symbol of wow, that's interesting. Richie showed me some stuff here for Mayan under, they have a jaguar god of the underworld, which is very similar.
That's
to
the symbolism panther. That's what came up in my head. I remember something in the Maya culture.
I'm trying to figure out how deep I want to go on some of this. Anyway, we'll talk about some of that in a minute, I think. But so back to the Cornstalk stuff. So one of the other beings that they paid homage to was the Thunderbird, which he's kind of the opposite of the Water Panther, right? So he's an underworld. Thunderbird's in the heavens, right? He's kind of a representative of the Great Spirit, you know, that kind of thing. And so the interesting thing is, like, even in Point Pleasant, but in Logan, West Virginia, whenever they uncovered some of the stuff there with the Native American community that Princess Aracoma was kind of a part of, like, they found, like, children with, like, Thunderbird necklaces, you know, so they're worshiping these same deities all over the place, which is an interesting connection point between some of these places.
And it's seeing the Thunderbird, or seeing, like, an oversized bird, was a common experience of almost everyone that we talk to in Kristen's extended family.
Yes.
The girl from Dark Holler.
That's right.
And not just her family either. The first night we were there, one of the later episodes, we'll get into it. You know, there was a sighting of a giant owl at one of the houses that we didn't really know why we were at the time.
Yeah. Really interesting stuff. Just connecting points between all this stuff. So so that's our experience at the Tuendi Way State Park. Some interesting things we probably need to follow up on there next time we go back, but anyway, we're pressed for time. So after that, we walk back across by the flood wall. And as we were walking there on the flood wall, we come across a group of some older men who are locals there. And, you know, they saw Ward's camera. And so they're interested in what exactly we're doing. And, you know, we're talking about the Mothman and, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, some of the reactions that they had was kind of interesting. It was like, so there, it was kind of like their take Mothman was bullcrap. But the UFO stuff, though.
Yeah.
There was no doubt about that.
Yeah, it's like everybody had their own sort of preference for the phenomena, which part of the phenomena they held to.
Yeah. But for us, it's all one and the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's I think it's because most people don't have the categories that we have for this stuff. But it was interesting, though, because of that, I thought. Like you know, we had people that are like, oh, you know, they hadn't had experiences with the Mothman, and they thought that that was kind of bogus. But like everybody there had talked about going to the TNT area and had seen UFOs there.
Right.
Which I thought was really interesting.
I mean, they don't really realize that one man's Mothman is another man's UFO. Like it's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was kind of like once you grant one, you grant the other. And, you know, for me too, it's, you know, I've looked into the Mothman phenomenon a little bit more since we've been home and had a little bit prior to going there. And one of the things that I noticed is like the Mothman phenomenon wasn't contained just to Point Pleasant. It was all around. Right, I mean, it's everywhere at this point. But I mean, you know, in the 60s, you had sightings in places like Clendenin, just outside of Charleston. You had them in Charleston. You had them in St. Albans, West Virginia. I mean, just all over that Kanawha County area. So it's kind of like, and it's all interesting because descriptions are consistent. You've got a being who's about 6 foot in height, wingspan of 10 feet. Red eyes. Everybody's talking about this. So it's like, well, it's a lot harder to just write that off as bogus whenever you have people who aren't connected in some way describing the same phenomena outside of that kind of epicenter. So I think that it's a little more difficult to just write that off. So
right.
And I mean, if Keel and I can't remember the name of the female journalist there in Point Pleasant,
Mary Heyer.
Yeah. I mean, if they're to be, unless they were just lying, you know, there were physical, like medical ramifications for a lot of the people that saw this thing close.
Yeah.
Talked about
conjunctivitis.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, so we talked about that. We even talked about some of the Native American stuff with them. You know, I was just interested to see. I think that there needs to be some major archaeological work done in Point Pleasant, honestly. And this goes to my hypothesis a little bit. So one of the hypotheses that I have, or hypotheses, I guess you could say, is so Cornstalk made a 200-year curse as he's dying. So he's worshiping a principality, you know, the Great Spirit, whatever you want to call it. But he's worshiping this being, and which is a principality that's been placed over the nations, which I think also explains a lot of the similar synchronicity that you have even here with some of Kristen's stuff from Darkholler. I think is one and the same here. But anyway, we were talking about that, and back to what I was saying. So he's worshiping this principality, and he makes a curse as he's being murdered. And the curse that he pronounces is a 200-year curse. So it's interesting that a lot of this stuff that happened, this Mothman phenomenon, occurs within that 200-year window. So you have the Mothman sightings actually started in the early 1900s there in the Ohio Valley. And originally it was called the Birdman, not right. The Mothman. And then it, you know, gets transformed into the Mothman later on when people get closer looks of it and they see the red eyes and, you know, that's some of that kind of stuff. But anyway, so it's interesting. So Cornstalk was murdered in 1777. In 1967, just a decade before the 200-year anniversary of his death, was when the Silver Bridge fell. So it's kind of interesting to me that this era of high strangeness really hits its peak in this 200-year window. So one of the hypotheses that I have, and it's just one, there's others, is that perhaps this window of high strangeness is opened up as a result of Cornstalk's principality worship. And this principality is a principality that's over perhaps
sort of a manifestation of the curse.
That's right. The phenomenon is a manifestation of this curse, which is carried out by a principality that is over this geographical region, which also connects the synchronicities that you have between all these different places. That's one of my hypotheses. Now, there could be other things, because there's certainly still yet strangeness going on there, which brings it outside of this 200-year mark. But yeah, that's kind of one of them that I'm working with so far. And I mean, I want to test that.
If you even look at the sort of anomalous nature of the phenomenon in general, I mean, how it reaches out to people in different cultural aspects and the masks that it used, it makes sense that if it were to reach out to the people of Appalachia and Point Pleasant, that it would take on the form of the Birdman. Right. I mean, that's an image they're familiar with, that they're associated with.
Well, and I want to save some of that.
And even like the symbolism with the mask that it takes on using UFO manifestations. If you look at the time in the nation's history, it's the 50s, the 60s. That's when classic UFO phenomena was exploding across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that's the reason why a lot of people go to Point Pleasant and don't just run into the Mothman much anymore.
Right.
Is because it's now taking on a mask. It's now taking on a mask that's more familiar to people, whereas that was kind of the mask for those people in that era, right?
Yeah, you can see an intelligence with the phenomena as it's trying to reach out to the various groups of people, manifesting differently to everybody.
Yeah. So anyway, so there's just so much there that we could go into, but I'll, for the sake of time, I'll move us along. But some of this stuff's going to come out more, because we've kind of got a project that we're working on talking about some of this stuff. So anyway, all right. So, you know, from there, so we go after that, we go to Mothman Museum, which is lit. You should go check that out if you're ever in Point Pleasant.
Disneyland for the weirdos.
Disneyland for the weirdos. We picked up some books by John Keel. We picked up like half of his library.
Yeah, we picked up like the library.
Yeah. And so we've got some of that with us here. You know, again, for those who are unfamiliar with John Keel, it's not that we agree with everything that Keel says,
right?
But some of the things that he says really, really make sense. And so overall, like I've even heard Mike Heiser talk about, you know, his unified theory in places and stuff. And so it really does fit in with a lot of this divine council worldview stuff that we're talking about. So anyway, so we go to the Mothman Museum. There we check out, you know, a lot of just the historical parts of this case. You know, there's pieces of the Silver Bridge there from when it fell. You know, there's documents that John Keel wrote while he was in the area. There's just a ton of stuff there about this case, right? And so, yeah, I don't know if there was anything there that caught your eyes that you want to talk about, but those were some of the things for me.
I mean, as touristy as it is, and it's, you know, unabashed by that, you know, again, there was there's a barred owl, like a taxidermied owl that's in the main gift shop area there.
Yeah. That was what I was about to go to.
But the owl's window.
Yeah.
Several of the Mothman depictions in there portray him very owl-like. And I mean, the reason for that is one of the speculations given, or the sort of rationalizations given for what people are seeing, was people were mistaking a large owl for...
Right, yeah.
So that's why that one was there. But then there was another one. You could see from the street outside through a window, there was another owl statue. And this one was
no
in
purpose.
This one was not in a place where it would do anything to birds. It was on the first story inside a window.
It was literally looking at the Mothman statue.
Yeah, facing the Mothman statue.
Yeah,
and in a room inside that no one's allowed access to. It's an employees only room inside. So it's not like part of the Mothman display.
Right.
I don't know. It was just another one like, oh, you know, I think that one is where I started to be like, okay, it doesn't seem just like, you know.
Yeah. That just triggered. So I want to dive into something so bad right now, but I can't.
I mean, go for it, man.
That's... I mean, I think it's part of the things that we're wanting to kind of.
Okay. Yeah. It's not.
Write it down. Write it down.
Yeah. Write it down. Yeah. We're not revealing the full hand here. A lot of that's going to be revealed later on. So you guys are going to have to stay tuned to what's coming in the future. So anyway, that's all I'll say. But yeah, so whenever we got to the Mothman Museum, we were hit right off the bat again with owl stuff. Like, we're sitting there, we're looking at the Mothman statue. It's in the center of town. And as we're sitting there looking, after Richie has done rubbed the steel bum of Point Pleasant on the...
That was a bucket list thing.
So we turn and look, and the owl is just staring right at us that Ward mentioned. And so we're like, huh, well, all right. Well, that one's just weirdly sitting there. So from there, you know, we go in, and then like just this stuffed one just looking at us. And then Ward, if I'm not mistaken, you actually asked the lady who was working there about the owls, and like she didn't even have a clue like about them.
Yeah, she either had no idea or didn't want to talk about it. She dodged or said she didn't know.
Yeah. So the first ones that we run into, you know, they're
it's almost like they're all conveniently sort of like placed and hidden, like almost in plain sight.
Yeah.
Like if you were passing by and looking at it, you would never
pay attention. Yeah. Yeah. It's like one of those things I said, we're standing there. I said, you know, at this point, I'm convinced that somebody's calling these places and just telling them we're coming.
Right. It's like, it's like sort of a hidden marker. Like if you're on the journey, like if you're in these categories, you'll see that owl, and it means something completely different than somebody passing it on the street.
Yeah. Right. So Mothman Museum, touristy, but, you know, interesting. So from there, we go grab some food, right? And we kind of come up with a plan of what we're going to do. So the next place that we go is the TNT area, which is where the Mothman was initially seen.
Oh, wait. Real quick. I also wanted to mention before, I don't know how many days ago it was. It wasn't very long ago. Richie had recommended to me the movie The Fourth Kind, in which... it's a movie about alien abductions, about, you know, encounters of the fourth kind. And the peoples that are being abducted, they populate their memory with an owl in place of the event, of seeing an owl in place of the abduction event. So I had just watched that a few days prior to going. So there's that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to watch that. I've not had a chance.
It's on Peacock. It's free to watch on there.
I'll have to check it out. So we go to, man, the more that I think about it, the TNT area was kind of interesting the more I think about it. So from there, we load up, we get out of town, we go north, we head out of town to the TNT area, which is on Potter's Creek Road. And I think that we hit like, so you guys will just have to look at it on a map, like, but the TNT area, Richie, you can tell people about the TNT area and kind of what it was originally used for.
The TNT area, it's before the military presence, was really Native American burial ground. I mean, there were natural burial mounds out there before the military presence. And when the military took over, it's recorded history that they literally bulldozed a lot of those mounds and built their own dome-shaped igloo munitions bunkers. And it was basically to store explosives and things during World War II.
Yeah, so I say this is right, you know, around the time of the Second World War. And, man, I saw some pictures online, and, like, it is insane what that place used to look like compared to what it looks like today. Like, I mean, it's basically a military town in it. I mean, it's just... crazy, you know, but now it doesn't look like that at all now.
Right. I mean, the design of the bunkers themselves is pretty smart, because anyone researching the history of the land would expect to see those dome shapes out there naturally from the burial mounds.
Yeah, so that's really genius.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So it's like an ecological disaster area, too. Apparently, the waters there are super polluted. There's a huge amount of energy being pumped in right there, too. There's a big power grid, big, gigantic power grid as you come through there, too. So anyway, so I think that we went to, I think it was the seventh run of those.
We went to probably the most visited section of the igloos that's out there. That's the ones that people gravitate to. It's the ones that are cleared out the most. And
I think those were the ones that also appeared in Hellier too.
Yeah.
So we get out there and oh boy, was that a long, long walk. So we get there and right off the bat in the very first igloo that we go into, there was some satanic symbolism in it. And, you know, just for the sake of poking the bee's nest, I wanted to kind of reclaim some of that area for the kingdom. So basically what I do is, I'm praying the entire time we're in there to myself. And then, I've got some anointing oil in my bag. And I actually draw crosses over the satanic symbolism. And Richie says that there was an EMF spike as soon as I actually broke those out. I didn't have the meter out at the time, so I don't know on my end. But I know that we did get various spikes in a few of those igloos while we were out there, which is interesting. Right. That's really, really interesting because, if I'm not mistaken, these are made out of concrete.
Concrete and steel.
Concrete, so they steel.
Block out any
types of signals.
Yeah, any sign of outside interference, radiation.
Yeah, we shouldn't actually
be able to be picked up in there.
Yeah, so we actually did a live stream while we were out in the TNT area, right? And we actually had to set the phone up outside of the igloo because once you go in there, it kills cell service. Like cell signal can't get in. So if the interesting part of that is this, and I've thought about this a little bit more since we've been back. It's interesting because since no kind of signal should get in there, you should not have any kind of spike of energy at all while you're in there.
Well, and you didn't, right? The EMF reader went dead, like as opposed to outside. As you get close to the power lines and stuff, it'll read. But when you get inside a bunker, it goes dead.
That's right. That's exactly right. It goes totally dead.
Right.
Like the baseline is like 0.000, like no, like zero. And then as we're walking in there, like I think you might have got some of it on video. One just was spiking, going just like crazy, like, you know, bumping from zeros to into the 30s and the 40s, and I think it went up maybe into the 80s at one point, which was really, really interesting because, like I said, you shouldn't have any types of EMF spikes in any of those places. So it's like if you encounter that, you know that there's something unnatural, I guess, going on in it,
right?
Because there's nothing natural there that would cause it. So, and even like you know, at first I was afraid that maybe, you know, it was the doorway. I was too close to the doorway or stuff like that. But, you know, even as a baseline, there was nothing going on outside of the doorway. So I've thought about that a little bit more since we got home. And so even that doesn't explain it. So something, definitely some EMF spikes happening for some reason in the TNT area. And then as we're out there, we're walking beside this large body of water. And one of the very first things we notice as we get about halfway down to about Mill's Run is a large, large bird just sitting on the tree, a tree right across from, I mean, like, so it was huge, like so noticeable. We're walking and we're looking over there. And one of the questions, I think it was maybe worth it, is like, what is that sitting on that tree over there? You know,
yeah, it was pretty far away to be able to
spotted
make it out. Yeah, it was, and it was big enough at, I don't know, it may have been 100 meters, maybe 75 to 100, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was weird, and it occasionally, it was just outside of where you could really tell much about it, except that it moved. You could tell that it was moving, so it was something alive.
Yeah, I had my iPhone, and I had my camera zoomed in to 15 times, and like whenever I would snap pictures of it, you could see it like occasionally like moving its head, like its head would be at a different angle. And then it took off finally. And I mean, it was massive animal. I don't know what kind of bird it was because it was so far away from us, but yeah, it ended up laying up in the treetops later, you know, somewhere else over there. But
and just that in and of itself is sort of a nod to the phenomenon as we've come to understand it from Darkhaller into our work now.
Yeah, right. And so from there, we walked out of one of the section of the igloos. We walked back to the next section, which we had to give up on because the mill run completely through it. And we thought that there was a land bridge there.
There was no land bridge.
There was no land bridge. Looked like a beaver dam to me. Kind of is what it looked like. Ward was going to test it out, but
we were all deceived.
Very
good. Insufficient footwear.
Insufficient footwear is what it was. That's right. I would really like to know how deep that was right there. Just, we should have got a stick.
Well, next time when, I don't know if we're revealing that there's a next time, but next time we should bring galoshes just for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, so we ended up having to walk. I mean, we walked forever.
I don't know. I could be in a wetsuit and just completely sealed off from the water. I probably wouldn't walk through it. I mean, that's just.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought about it a little bit more. I was like, you know what? I'm glad we didn't get in this sketchy water.
Yeah.
Because it got massive pollution. Because,
I mean, it is registered as an ecological disaster.
Yeah.
So the
which is still yet on the list of the government to take right. care of, from what I understand.
Yep. So there's still some sketchiness in the water.
Yeah. All right. And so that would basically summed up our time in the TNT area. We checked that out. Again, just like it was in the other areas that we were at, just these weird connecting points, right? EMF spikes, birds.
These little high strangeness breadcrumbs to keep us going down the trail.
Yeah, which connects, again, back to Darkhaller. So for us, like, those are things that most people wouldn't even notice or pay attention to, probably. But for us, you know, it is. So from there, we kind of regroup. At this point, Ward's going to have to leave, you know, not too far down the road. He's going to drive back to Ohio. And so we're like, okay, well, we'll go check out the Low Hotel, which, Richie, you've stayed at
several times.
You can tell people about the Low Hotel.
The Low Hotel has been there since, what'd she say, the
early, it was 1901, I think.
Yeah, something like that. I know it has a history of being a brothel at one point.
Oh.
And there's some just, there was illegal activities ran from it, a speakeasy at one point.
I could totally
see that. Just different things like that. And over the years, it's gained a reputation for being a pretty haunted location. That's what drew us to it in the beginning a few years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually did a little bit of research on it whenever I got home. And from what I understand, it is like notoriously haunted.
Right.
Like, I guess like poltergeist type phenomena, that type of thing. But it's in like the top 10 of like the United States, like most haunted hotels.
And, right. The lower floors tend to be, residual reports of activity, but the third floor and the ballroom is where you have people reporting intelligent interactions with spirit.
Which is interesting because the entire time that we were in the hotel, so we met the owner, she's very nice, very gracious. She gave us a tour of the hotel. We came in, Ward had his camera. If you want clearance to do anything, all you got to do is have Ward and his camera.
Right.
She was like, who are you guys with? We're like, you know, we're just doing a project and, you know, we didn't, you know, go too in much detail. She's like, well, I'll give you a tour of the building.
Yeah, if we have Ward, we have a permit.
Yeah, it's like, I have a permit. Yeah. So anyway, so she gives us a tour of the building, and the entire time that we're doing this, I'm running EMF. And bottom floor, nothing. Second floor, which was where the first, I don't know if it was a conference room or a ballroom, meant like a, where she was telling us that there were like psychics and
stuff. That was like the mezzanine area.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently there was some psychics and stuff there.
Yeah. That's where they used to hold gallery readings and paranormal events.
That's interesting. So second floor, nothing at all. Then we hit the third floor, which is the notoriously haunted floor. EMF meter was spiked the entire time we were on the third floor.
I remember you leaned the meter over there to me a few times so I could see it.
Yeah. I kept showing the meter to you and Ward the entire time. I'm like, okay, we're spiked. Like it didn't drop any either. It just stayed that way the entire time. And then you had the rooms there, which was, you know, 314 and 316, I think, which were supposed to be notoriously haunted rooms, which we checked out. She showed those to us. We're doing some interesting art there.
Yeah. So aside from the one that I paid the least attention to there was the depiction of the ladder to heaven with the person ascending it. But yeah, there were several pieces by an artist who works out of Huntington now, named Jamie Sloan, and they're all very, like they're objectively, I don't know if you would say beautiful. They're objectively very well done. There's certainly something surreal and a bit otherworldly about them, and that's how they strike you prior to being told what they're about. One of them is a depiction of an entity that the artist saw, I believe, as his father was in hospice and passing away. He saw this entity and then painted it. And then another one is a pretty interesting, possibly just optical illusion, but there's a painting of a girl holding a carnation, and her eyes are closed, but apparently a lot of people have the same reaction to it, where from some distance it appears that one of the eyes opens.
Yeah.
And I got as close as I could, and I think that that's mostly an optical illusion based on the shape of the shadow on the girl's eyelid on her right eye. But if it's an optical illusion, it's certainly intentional. And your mind does play a weird trick. Like looking at it through the camera, I didn't really see it as much. But the first time I looked at it, my mind did that thing where it's trying to decide between the two options. Is it closed? Is it open? So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so... So we had that going on there. There was also like a lot of story of like orbs being photographed in the hallways. And there was a room there too, the captain's room.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the story on that was. I can't remember that.
I know on the third floor in 314 and 316, people have, that was in the, there used to be a book in there where people could record their experiences. And I flipped through it a bunch of times when I was there, but for some reason it wasn't there this time when we were there. And they talk about a riverboat captain that people have waking up in the night, and he's standing at the end of their beds looking out towards the window and pointing people out towards the window, like trying to get their attention. And I guess he's seen all over the third floor.
Hmm. Yeah. I also saw that there was one of the major reported phenomena was a little girl who apparently was the youngest daughter of the original owner of the Low Hotel, where apparently she died. And apparently they say that she, you know.
Right. That's where the reports of a little girl riding like sort of a tricycle, like the squeaking of the noise of the wheels. On a few times that I've stayed there, we've actually heard that in the night in the hallway.
Yeah. So from there too, we went up to the ballroom, and the ballroom was where.
But also for the rooms that they make it a really poignant thing to focus the hauntings to 316, 314.
Yeah.
Like those are the really the focal points of the anomalous activity, it seems.
Which, and again, yeah, I mean, we had EMF spikes the entire time that we were there. So something definitely going on the third floor.
Right. And even taking the artwork that's there and placing it in the rooms.
Yeah. That's an interesting choice. That's for sure.
Interesting choice.
Yeah. And so from there, we go to the top of the floor, which is the ballroom, this grand ballroom. And that was where, you know, Jamie Sloan, who's the artist, that was kind of serving at his studio, if I'm understanding correctly. And so interesting as we went up there, because the EMFs actually stopped, but the temperature dropped like 10 degrees, which is weird. Okay, here's why it's weird. Because heat goes up. Like, okay, so we're in an old building right now, which is where our church meets. And we it's a two-story building. And right now, like I had to put my jacket on while we were down here because it's chilly down here.
Yeah.
But if you go upstairs, significantly hotter upstairs than it is. And that's because heat rises, okay? Total opposite there. Third floor was really hot. And then whenever we went up, I actually think I talked to Ward and showed it to Ward, the meter. I was like, it just got really cold up here. So, you know, no EMF spikes up there, but significant drop in temperature, which again, really odd. You would not expect that because heat rises. So anyway, so.
Also, I think that room was, she called it storage. I don't think Sloan actually works out of that. I think he just kept those three paintings there that he did. She said during the mock.
Gotcha. Okay.
Wait, so, are you talking about
the top floor?
The top floor, or are you talking about the top section of the art gallery where there was easels
the ballroom.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. And so from there, speaking of the art gallery, okay, so there she takes us to the art gallery. And some really interesting things in the art gallery.
See, that's what I thought you were talking about when you were talking about the studio, because there was a studio space above the art gallery where you could sit, where you could tell they work on art up there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's what it was. Okay. I misunderstood her then. So, okay. So from there we go, which is also has a business front downtown in Point Pleasant. It's connected to the Low Hotel. But there is a art studio there. And apparently, you know, Low Hotel really enjoys art and supports artists and, you know, that kind of thing. And so whenever we get there, I'll let you guys tell the story. What did we find?
Well, there's a lot of artwork that they have there. Some of it by an artist that I think lived prior to, like, I think he died in 1948, named Philippe Schmidt, who a lot of his, yeah, there you go. We got a brochure there. A lot of his work is, it's just interesting. It's rich with symbolism. Yeah, Richie's got some of them there. And you can, a lot of it is owned, not by the hotel, but by a religious movement called the Lord's New Church, based on the thought of a guy named Emanuel Swedenborg, or Swedenborg.
Yeah.
And Schmidt was heavily influenced by Swedenborg. Actually, in some of the pretty interesting pieces we saw, there's a direct references to Swedenborg, as well as there was a bunch of his literature there. So a lot of like religious overtones in the imagery, and just interesting pieces.
Yeah. So one of the I won't go into too much detail, just because we're kind of, you know, saving some of it for other.
Yeah, if it seems like we're being intentionally vague, it's because we are. I mean, there's a lot about this case that we're not ready to really comment on yet.
Yeah, well, you know, interesting thing is, you know, there was some just hermetic works, you know, there as well, that were kind of, you know, attached to Swedenborg. From what I understand, Swedenborg was, he was a theological thinker, but not only was he a theological thinker, but his work also influenced a lot of folks who are in kind of hermeticism, if I'm understanding correctly as well. So, interesting connection points there, interesting things going on. And so, yeah, so that's basically the trip. We did not see the Mothman while we were there.
That we know of.
So
I'm convinced we met the phenomenon in some way.
Okay.
So all right. Technically we did meet the Mothman.
So let's speak to that. Okay. So people are hearing this, they're like, oh, the episode's called On the Trail of the Mothman, but you didn't see the Mothman. But there were still some things going on there. So speak to that. You said that you think that we met the phenomena, but okay, just dive into that a little bit.
All the things that we saw that we thought were anomalous, that we thought were synchronicities, it's literally the phenomena speaking our language. Like, it's the symbolism we've come to know working these cases that's unique to us.
Oh, okay. So you're saying that it's wearing a mask. Mask that we would recognize. So very similar to the Point Pleasant stuff.
Right.
Phenomena is wearing a mask that the people of that time and of that era is familiar with. I think that's really interesting.
The people tied to the land knew of the Birdman. That was something associated as sort of an elemental spirit of the land. So that's the mask it took on.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really interesting. So we're, I don't know if you want to speak to maybe some of the things that we've got that we're thinking about doing with some of this stuff. Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to let it kind of develop organically. We don't know how long we might be engaged in this pursuit. I don't want to necessarily call it an investigation. I don't know. You guys can invent the language on that, but I think
absolutely an active investigation.
And yeah, I think, you know, I was there not just to kind of experience it and investigate with you, but I was collecting footage because I think, you know, one of the interesting things that I'm looking at sort of past the Kristen's story and her family story in Dark Holler has to do with, you know, okay, now what? Okay, what does this mean for how people ought to view the world, I guess? And since you guys started the podcast and stuff, I've been interested in like pointing people to it. And, you know, I think this is the natural outgrowth. We talked about this probably a year ago. Seems like the thing to do is to, you know, I'm a noob at all this. I've only been into researching and studying this stuff for a couple of years, but like, you know, Richie, your background is incredibly deep. So I would rather, you know, stay behind the camera and document kind of what you guys are doing to offer a window into what it looks like to look at the fringe through the lens of the Christian worldview. Because I think we, you know, this ought to be the church's birthright. This ought to be where the authority of Christ is brought. So,
I think that's good. And I'll say it this way. I think for me, so a lot of people may be listening and they may be saying, oh, but they didn't see the Mothman. And for me, I guess here's kind of how I'm viewing it. I think that there are certainly some strange things happening in Point Pleasant.
I still hold to it that we did. We made first introductions, and it's only getting started.
Here's what I'm, and I think that each of us have our own interests and kind of own unique place in this. And for me, I think for sure we actually came out of there with a lot more information than what we went in with. And I think that we actually got to see and understand that for a long time, there has been I'll just call it a principality in that land that has been worshiped. And because of that, it has manifested spiritual phenomena since then. Now, of course, we didn't meet the Mothman, but I certainly think that the entity between all of that, behind all of that phenomena is certainly still there, is certainly still yet at work, but in some new and unique ways, which we are investigating and are going to continue to flush out
right
as time goes along. And you guys are going to be a part of that.
I mean, you might as well just put it out there. There's going to be at least a part two to our investigation there.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And
maybe more than that.
Yeah, the whole purpose of the first visit was to get a foundation established.
Yeah, I think for me is what it is. It's we've talked about things like principalities and elemental spirits and all that. I feel like that in some ways, it's this work that we've done here is looking at the phenomena that has come from that type of spiritual being in that region and documenting it in a real way, which I don't know if anybody else has ever done. Right. I mean, other than John Keel And the people who were there with the initial Mothman stuff and all of the high strangeness there that accompanied that with the men in black and the genital mutilations right. and the UFO, I don't think anybody else has documented this stuff. This, I still think that this thing is very much a live case, and this thing is manifesting itself in strange ways. Perhaps it doesn't look like the Indian pagan worship that it once did, but maybe it's a pagan worship still yet in some ways. But I still yet think that it's very much going on there. And so we are kind of doing first boots on the ground since then, since that time from the 60s, documenting a lot of this stuff. Right. Now, I think that everybody's going in looking for the wrong thing.
Right. And you ask, why Appalachia? Why this group of people? And I mean, culturally, our community here is cut off from the rest of the country, the rest of the world. I mean, we live in our own little world out here. And these people here are very superstitious, very spiritually focused. So it makes sense that if the phenomenon was going to reach out to anybody, it would be those people who are, you know, marginalized in liminality.
Yeah. Yeah. There was something else I was going to say to that, but I don't remember what it was now. But yeah, I think that the work that we're doing here is, it's connected to Dark Holler. I think that what a lot of people experience here, and to speak to your point, in Appalachia, is because of this type of principality, right. that type of thing. And it's manifested itself in different ways. Perhaps it's manifested itself in Flatwoods as a Flatwood monster. Perhaps it's manifested itself in the High Strangeness Flap in Point Pleasant. Perhaps it's manifested itself in Boone County through the demonic possession of Kristen Bellamy. And it's manifesting itself in all kinds of ways. And we are going to be the ones who are documenting this phenomena. And that's the work that we're doing now.
Right. The phenomena speaking to Appalachia, and we're going to showcase the various masks.
Yeah. And take back some ground along the way.
Right.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Prayerfully take back some ground.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens, he says. All right. Well, guys, do you guys, either of you have anything else you want to say before we sign? I feel like that we kept everybody in suspense until the last moment.
I have tons to say, but I'm not allowed.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So here's what I'll say. If you guys are interested in following this journey, that I promise you nobody else is doing, you need to follow along. This stuff is developing. Well, you guys are on the front end of it. I'll say that you guys are, it's developing here right now for you guys in the same way that it is for us. You guys are learning as we are learning. We're going to continue doing this. Who knows where it's going to lead us? It may lead us to places like the Serpent Mound in Ohio. You know, who knows where, you know, this, we're going to end up with this. And so if you guys are interested in being a part of that, the way that you can become a part of it and stay up to date is not only following us on social media and all these things, but becoming a patron over to our Patreon. Not only do you get the Sword and Staff Uncut for just $5 a month, but you also get all of the other stuff. We release exclusive things on our Patreon that we don't release anywhere else. Okay. And so at some point, though, all this stuff is going to get released to where everybody can see it. But if you want to be on the cutting edge of things, if you want things first, if you want some of the background conversations that we're not going to have publicly elsewhere, you need to go to our Patreon, right? www.patreon.com/swordandstafforder. Get the Sword and Staff Uncut for just $5 a month and get the loaded bonus content that you're not going to hear on Apple Podcast or Spotify or Stitcher or wherever it is that you're listening in. So, well, guys, I don't have anything else to say other than it's been a fun ride so far, and this is just the beginning. Looking forward to what comes afterwards. So,
same.
All right. Well, Ward, thank you so much for joining us again. Been a real pleasure. Looking forward to doing more of this in the future. And yeah, that's all I've got. So, well, guys, thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next week.
See you then.
See you then.